Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Welcome to part two of our conversation with Greg Lawson, the paranormal detective.
What sort of cases, I'd love to hear an example if you have one, that you came across when investigating claims of demons or something in that category, ghosts, paranormal, things of that nature, when it was a mental health call, where you did walk away from that, or as you investigated, you really kind of got perplexed and you felt maybe there is something more than a mental illness going on here.
Well, there's a lot of that with like charismatic or Pentecostal churches, and you end up having somebody. The interesting thing is, and I'm gonna fall back. I was gonna get a degree in psychology until I realized I didn't want to hear your freaking problems.
Yeah,
you know, sure. So I was like, oh, that's kind of self-serving there. Maybe I shouldn't be a psychologist. And yeah. So I look at this stuff in a different way. And the interesting thing about these experiences is they're typically contemporary to today's society, right? Mm-hmm. It's typically related to today's technology. So when I was working as a mental health officer, if you're working midnights, you know, it could be busy up until 2 o'clock in the morning. And then after 2 o'clock, it's pretty nothing moving, nothing going on. And so if you're working midnight shift, there's not much to do. So you go down and hang out at one of the hospitals because, you know, the staff there is all awake all night long. So, you know, you have some place to go. I used to go to the state hospital and I would go over to the admissions building and get the keys to the old main building, which was condemned at the time. And that was built in the 1850s and has a basement and has the old snake pits and all that stuff that they used to basically torture people to try to scare, you know, the mental illness out of them. They'd, you know, put them in ice baths and they would just do all kinds of horrific stuff to them. And so I would go over to the old main building and I would go down into the basement. And in the basement, those were the would be the isolation cells down there. Now, when I was going down there, there had been a court order and they had to take off all the big oak wooden doors off of the cells down there. And so all those doors were off and leaning up against the wall, and they were using this area for storage. So there were boxes and boxes of old hospital records. So I would go down in there and I would go try to find the oldest box I could find and go through it. And in the 1870s, prior to, you know, the birth of modern psychology, I guess, you know, a lot of the doctors there, physicians there that dealt with mental illness, they called themselves alienists because people with mental illness were alien from society. So they would study quote unquote as alienists. And they had basically three diagnoses that they would put you in the hospital for. One was consumption or tuberculosis. So they were taking normal people that had tuberculosis and putting them into mental facilities, which would of course spread the tuberculosis to some of the existing patients that were already there, and it was a really bad situation. So tuberculosis. The other one was religious, and then the third one was masturbation.
Wow.
Yeah, no, it's a terrible thing. And apparently, so you look at behavior. Now, you're not going to find news articles or reports and stuff from the 1870s about guys running around in public doing this. Mm-hmm. Because that's not something that they talked about. That was something that, you know, somebody did that. You grabbed them, you threw them in the state hospital, and you kept them there and kept them off the street.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you think about it, guys who don't have any interaction with women for whatever reason in the 1870s, they didn't have the internet to go to look at photos. They didn't have, you know, pornographic books. They didn't have movies. They didn't have any of that stuff to, you know, extend their fantasy. So they would find themselves, you know, where groups of women would be, mm-hmm. you know, and like I've been in law enforcement. I think it's about 28 years, and I've never worked a peeping case. You know,
yeah,
but that's, I know some cops that have, but they're very few, because it's just there's plenty yeah. of visual stimulation and all kinds of different mediums
yeah.
to go to. But back then, when there wasn't that, you know, these guys were creeping around at night, looking in people's windows and stuff.
Sure.
And so anyway, it was just really interesting to be able to look at that and those experiences and just kind of see where that went. So the religious diagnosis would have been from, you know, demons or some sort of possession, or they think they're Jesus, or they see angels and all this stuff. But there were no UFO stuff. I didn't come across anything that had anything to do with extraterrestrials. Nothing. And so that's where I'm going with this. I could go on and on about this, supporting this idea, but it seems that a lot of these experiences are, you know, your expectations, what is going on now, and now would be, you know, NSA watching you, CIA watching you, alien abductions, that sort of thing. And while there's a lot of religious increase, believe it or not, in the United States, the religion is on the increase, mm-hmm. and as opposed to in Europe and Asia, where it's on the decrease. These experiences are still fairly commonplace, but not nearly as commonplace as, you know, technology experiences like UFOs and stuff.
Sure. It's almost as if over the time periods, whatever the current, you know, hot button entity is, whether it be an alien, whether it be demons, whether it be a form of the government that's watching, that seems to be what people go to when they have an experience. And sometimes it may not be to dismiss the experience that someone is happening. It's just that's what our minds naturally then assign to the unknown. We don't know what it is. Well, then what are the unknown options that are out there that this could be? And then yep. individuals jump to one of those conclusions, whether it's that or not. And then it's hard to get someone off of that conclusion once they've gone there.
It absolutely is. And you know, the interesting thing is we were talking about perception and how we see things. Well, all this stuff, this modern stuff influences how we see things. And in the paranormal world, I like to revert back to type one and type two errors of heuristics. So if you're studying heuristics, you're looking at what are the common things you learn that you take throughout your whole life that helps you better navigate your world and make better decisions. The little things like, you know, rules of thumb and that sort of stuff. And there's a thing in heuristics called type one errors and type two errors. Type one error would be an example of that would be, let's say you're a soldier and you're walking through a jungle and a bush rustles. You know, so there's movement in a bush. Well, you turn toward the bush, you point your weapon toward the bush, and you cover the bush and try to figure out what it is. Mm-hmm. And you realize, oh, it was just the wind. So then you take your weapon away from the bush and you continue on your walk. Now, if you do that, enough, you'll walk by the bush and the bush rustles and you'll automatically go, oh, it's just the wind. Problem is, you just made a type two error because it wasn't. It was a tiger that was in there and it jumps out and eats your face off, right?
Sure.
So you always want to err on the side of type one errors. You know, you want to go, oh, what was that? Oh, okay. That's what it is. Now we move on. You don't want to just dismiss it as something you magically realize is going on, as opposed to interpreting it from your real environment.
Sure.
So, yeah, you know, it's just it's interesting stuff, I think.
Specifically identifying what it is that's out there. And that's I think, where a lot of, you know, the paranormal investigation community comes in. That's what they're trying to do. That, you know, that's what they're out there. It's like, well, we this happened. You know, somebody saw this shadow person. They're not necessarily saying it's Aunt Betty, and they're not saying it's the devil, but it's something happened. Something made this occur. What is it? And that's where we're all getting so perplexed, and that's where we have this world that we have in terms of paranormal investigating. Do you believe there's any specific category or as far as the type of building or organization that would likely hold more paranormal energy than others? Examples being a religious building or structure or a hospital, things of that nature. Is there anything that stands out to you that you could drive down the road and somebody would say, what building do you think is haunted? And you have no knowledge of any stories, but you were to say, odds are that one right there, because.
Okay. Yes. I say yes, because I go off of, you know, if there was a mathematical equation, mm-hmm. right? So what is the building made of? What was it made for? What was it used for? What was the experiences that happened there? And what are the interpretations of the paranormal stuff coming out of it? So if you look at a building, let's say a Buffalo Billiards in Austin, Texas, down on 6th Street. You look at Buffalo Billiards and it is a pool hall slash restaurant bar, right? And it's a really amazing place. Well, the cool thing is you start doing the research on it and it was a hospital. And they had doctors working there, and they were sending patients there that were terminally ill, and a lot of people died out of there. And so it has a great history. It's made out of limestone. And, you know, there's all kinds of theories as far as, you know, limestone and what properties it might have in connection to the spiritual realm. And those are all, you know, conjecture. They're all, people are just putting their ideas into it. Nothing's really factual on that, but still all of this comes from somewhere. So if I look at a building like that, I think, okay, that would be one of the things I would look at. I do seminars on cold case investigation, and what I do is take the cold case investigation model from law enforcement and just apply it to paranormal. And you'll come up with a lot of different answers and a lot of different methods to conducting your investigation. One of the things in the paranormal field, or in cold case also, is prior to the 1920s, 1910s or so, cops didn't write any reports. That's what testimony was for. That's what you said, you know, in front of a jury, and you told your story. So prior to that, no one was documenting things. We had one of the first serial killers in the United States was here in Austin, Texas. And it's, you know, you hear everything about, H.H. Holmes and Jack the Ripper and all that stuff. This was before both of them. And this individual killed 8 people and did it all pretty much the same way. And it was terrifying because he would come into your house at night while you were asleep and whack you and your wife in the head with an axe and drag her out and have his way with them. And whether they were murdered before he did or after, it was a terrifying thing. And you look at those types of cases. That's kind of where I go with my investigations, is how can I support it? So where am I going to get this information? The only person that was writing everything or writing anything in the 1880s was the newspaper. So you have to go into the newspapers. If you're doing any kind of paranormal investigation, you got to find out what newspaper covered that area. And you go in and you glean out as much information as you can about what was going on in that area and whether or not there was an actual case or whatever. I found one of a great ghost story from the 1870s, and, or it would have been 1850s. And, you know, nobody would have known about that except for this woman wrote this in a letter and sent it to her sister. And then it stayed in a trunk for, you know, 100 plus years, and somebody found it and then posted it. And then I, you know, went over and talked to them. They live locally, and it's pretty amazing. So I kind of have to correlate everything through that. When I do an investigation now, let's say somebody had, I did an investigation on a house that at that time it was about 10 years old. And the family that was there, they would hear giggling and they would hear squeaking. And their kid had an imaginary friend. And they were really concerned about it. And they took the child to a psychologist. Psychologist said, "Oh, this is normal. She'll grow out of it," kind of thing. And they ended up getting in touch with me, and I talked to them, and I came over and looked at the house and said, "All right, well, I'll do a run up on this." And there was actually another ghost investigating team that was working on this, and I was kind of supporting them. And so I look up the tax records. I look at up all the plat maps and all this stuff. And I mean, the place was basically a goat farm until some builders came out and constructed this big neighborhood, and they put up all these houses, and there it is. So I sit back and I go, okay, well, what has happened in this house in the last 10 years since it's been here? So I'll look up all the 911 reports, you know, any EMS calls, fire, law enforcement, anything, nothing. So I report back to them. I'm like, yeah, you know, I don't know. The family that was there, they were the second family to occupy the house. And I said, I can't find anything that happened here. I'm sorry. Thanks. Mm-hmm. The guy's like, all right, no problem. He moves on. After about a month or so, I went, you know what? I'm going to follow up on the family that was there before. So I followed up on that family. They actually had moved to Houston, and their daughter, they had a young daughter. She was 7, came down with cancer and passed away, which immediately lends a little bit of credibility to the giggling and laughing, because you could infer that that little girl returned to the house she was happiest at.
Sure.
That was her little happy house there in Austin. And when she moved, she went to Houston and they diagnosed her with cancer and she dies. So that's not a scientific method right there, but you know, that's something that you have to look at. And it can be very broad, you know, and you talk to any, I'm using air quotes again, true believer syndrome. Somebody who's like, doesn't matter what you say, that orb in that photo is grandma and she's there to protect me. You know, it's mm-hmm. like, okay, all right. I don't know where you're getting that, but okay. You know, there's nothing I can do about that interpretation. So the true believers would look at this, and if I had not have found this little girl, they would have just said, well, the house is probably buried on an Indian burial ground.
Sure.
Or, you know, buried on top of a caveman. That was, you know, or something. And so there's always answers that can be inferred based on your interpretation of the evidence. Not the evidence itself, but your interpretation of the evidence.
What do you make of a situation like that where, let's say, and I'm not saying this happened in this case, but an example would be other cases that are somewhat similar where they don't know who the spirit is, what may be going on. They end up identifying a tragedy that took place, someone who had passed in a house. They're suspecting it's a little girl. A team goes in with some sort of modernized equipment to communicate, and they do get some sort of evidence, whether it be through a spirit box or EVP or whatever, insert piece of equipment here, that identifies the name of the girl or something very, very specific, more so than just we heard a girl's voice, but something that really, really points in a direction, I think, as close as we can get to definitive proof that that's who it is. It said the first and last name of the girl that died and we're in that house. What's your take on that?
Well, just because I've seen very, very few direct interpretations of something like that. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna fall back to a story at Warwick Castle in the United Kingdom. So I'm at Warwick Castle. I was there with a guy named Frank Sinelli. He's the He is a very experienced, him and his wife are very experienced paranormal investigators. He's referred to as Dr. Specter, if you want to look him up. He's a really good guy. I like working with him. And so we were down in the basement of Warwick Castle, and we were running a spirit box. And they were asking certain questions. And, you know, that's one of those things. Spirit boxes lends or creates an exciting environment to what you would imagine is the most boring thing in the world, to sit in a, you know, in a room with no lights on and, you know, try to have an experience. So it's nice to, you know, for entertainment value, you throw a piece of technology in there that, you know, you believe the spirit world can manipulate and can give you answers through. So the way most spirit boxes work is they're either AM or FM or receiver, and they're on constant scan mode. So it just scans from channel to channel, whatever is happening on that channel for that half second or so will come through the spirit box. So you get all kinds of just gibberish. And every once in a while, you get something really interesting. Now, we're down there, and we're listening to the spirit box, and it's saying, Bill, Greg, you know, it's going through all its noise. Mm-hmm. And the door opened up in this room, and a person stepped into the room. And the door closed. And whenever you're doing any kind of EVP work, we were recording this, so something unusual happened. You identify that unusual thing that's not paranormal. And so somebody there said, someone just entered the room. And Frank asked the spirit box, he said, can you tell me who just came in the room? And across the spirit box was the word Duncan. It was that clear, that pronounced. And Duncan was the one that had just walked through the door. So, in, like I said, the scientific materialist in me, I wasn't really good at algebra too much in high school. I got it a little bit later, and I studied trigonometry when I was in college. And, man, I started going through statistical analysis for behavioral sciences, trying to figure out, you know, what are the likelihood of this guy walking in this room and this spirit box clicking on Duncan.
Picking up a Dunkin' Donuts ad or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was miraculous, you know. One in a million. Yeah. Okay. So it was miraculous. It was incredible. And just like the Lepp Castle photograph, that imprinted in my mind that strongly. Of course, so as a homicide investigator, you always say, well, there's no such thing as a coincidence. Now, in paranormal, it's different. So to answer your question, when you're looking at these things and certain things happening, the first thing you got to do is eliminate all the normal stuff. So if there's something going on, especially like some sort of technology, and it says, you know, who the people that are working it, the investigators are working, it says, you know, who am I talking to? Comes back, I'm Lisa. That's pretty amazing. And I've heard some EVPs like that. The first thing you have to do is determine whether or not you're being hoaxed, because that's the most likely scenario. If you look back at history, I know this is offensive to some folks, but if you look back at history, there's much more involvement of the amazing things that have happened, and they come back as hoaxes. You know, Uri Geller, bending spoons, and just that sort of thing.
Sure.
So I go to that first, and I eliminate that, and whatever's left over is my paranormal evidence, as opposed to going straight to the evidence to support the story. So I look to investigate the phenomenon, not to prove there was a ghost. There's a different perspective. It's a mindset that you go into, and on subject, but kind of in a different context. I I went to a fort on Lantau Island. It's right off of the coast of China near Hong Kong. And I wanted to go to Lantau Island because I wanted to go to the monastery. They have one of the last Shaolin monasteries in the world there. And I wanted to go there. I'm kind of a martial artist, and I wanted to go and you know, see what the monks do. So I went and stayed there for about 3 days. And one of the days that I was there, I took a cab ride, and we went over to a fort, old Chinese fort. And it was put on this hill overlooking the ocean because they were having problems with piracy. And so I went over there, and I was expecting it to be like you had to, you know, pay to get in and go and have some sort of tour or something. It wasn't like that at all. It was on a dirt road. The cabbie just stopped, let me off, pointed toward the woods. There was a little sign that I couldn't read. I walked down the trail, and there's this foundation of this fort overlooking the ocean. It was really pretty cool place. As soon as I got there into the foundation, there was this bird that flew down, and he landed on the ground in front of me, and he's hopping around, and he's making a bunch of noise. He's hopping around. Now, being from Central Texas, we have birds called killdees, and they look kind of like a seagull, except they're smaller. They have skinny legs, and they run real fast on the ground. And in Central Texas, they're in big fields, and you're walking through a field, and you'll see a killdee, and he'll be running away from you at an angle. And if you don't follow him, he'll run back, and he'll flop around on the ground like his wing is broken. And he'll try to get you to follow him because he wants you to go away from his nest. He doesn't want you at the nest, so he's doing that. So I was interpreting this Chinese bird was trying to distract me from his babies or protect his nest or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I was just kind of blowing him off. And I spent a couple of hours there looking around. I was looking for, you know, the graveyard. I was looking for any signs of, you know, anything paranormal. And this bird followed me, man, the whole time, jacking with me, flying back and forth. And I'm like, get out of the way, bird. You know, you're irritating. Get out of the way. So I'm doing my, you know, my ghost investigation stuff. And I find an area where I think that was the cemetery. And because there was enough occupation there for long enough to where people died and they would have had to have stuck him in the ground somewhere. So I went and found that. And then I end up leaving. Well, later, come to find out that there's these particular birds in China or in the Orient that the gods send to you to send you a message. And I was so self-absorbed in what I expected to experience at this fort, I completely disregarded and negated what could possibly be the real experience I was supposed to have, which was a message from the gods by this bird, whatever that means.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of times paranormal investigators have a preconception notion in mind of what they're going to do when they get someplace, and their ideas and their expectations are lead them down the wrong path. And that's happened to me many times.
That wraps up the second half of our conversation with Greg Lawson, paranormal detective. Be sure to check out his books wherever books are sold and on Amazon. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.